From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The New York City police came down on dissident speech during the RNC week with an iron boot.
The Republican National Convention has ended, but the legal battles are just beginning. We look at the tactics used by the police here in New York. Then, 7 years ago, Humboldt County police officers used Q-tips soaked with pepper spray and applied them to the eyes of nonviolent activists.
It is my intention, if you do not leave, to use pepper spray or chemical mace to extricate you from your those steel cases.
Today, the trial begins in California. We'll speak with the lead counsel and one of the young activists. We'll also talk to Tariq Ramadan, one of Europe's most influential Islamic thinkers. He was supposed to be teaching at Notre Dame University, but the Department of Homeland Security has just revoked his visa. First, we'll go to Baghdad, where the number of U.S. troops killed in Iraq has topped 1,000. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the U.S. military death toll has now topped 1,000. All but 140 of the deaths have come since May 1st, 2003, when President George Bush declared major combat operations in Iraq to be over. Bush spoke on that day under a banner that read, "Mission Accomplished." Yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld defended the invasion and said the people of Iraq are, quote, better off today than they were a year ago in every conceivable respect. The number of Iraqis killed over the last 18 months is unknown. The website Iraq Body Count estimates at least 11,800 Iraqi civilians have been killed, but some estimates put the Iraqi civilian death toll three times as high. Yesterday, Rumsfeld said U.S.-backed forces had killed between 1,500 and 2,500 Iraqis in the past month alone. He claimed the dead were, quote, former regime elements, criminals, terrorists. In Fallujah, the U.S. launched another large attack, reportedly killing 100 Iraqis. The New York Times is reporting the U.S.-backed Iraqi government has no control over Fallujah and other cities in the Sunni Triangle. In Baghdad, two 29-year-old Italian women working with the peace group Bridge to Baghdad were kidnapped yesterday, along with two of their Iraqi co-workers. The BBC reports more than 100 foreigners have been kidnapped in Iraq since March 2003. In an interview with the Washington Times, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld accused Iran of fueling the resistance in Iraq. Rumsfeld said, quote, "They have put people in there, they've put money in there, and it's a very difficult thing to stop," he said. He said Iran is a country that's not part of the civilized world in terms of its behavior. Rumsfeld claimed the Bush administration is finding it difficult to convince other countries to pressure Tehran to stay out of Iraq. The Boston Globe is reporting today a reexamination of President Bush's military records show the president fell well short of meeting his military obligations in the Texas Air National Guard during the Vietnam War. According to the Globe, twice during his Guard service, in May 1968 and in mid-1973, Bush signed documents pledging to meet training commitments or face a punitive call-up to active duty. But records show he didn't meet the commitments or face the punishment. In 1973, when Bush transferred out of his unit to attend Harvard Business School, Bush agreed to be assigned to another reserve unit within 60 days, but records show he never signed up with a Boston area unit. And the Globe investigation has determined that Bush's attendance in 1972, 73, and 74 was so irregular that his superiors could have disciplined him or ordered him to active duty, but they did neither. just 4 months after Bush's commanding officer wrote that Bush had not been seen at his unit for the previous 12 months. That was after Bush's unit certified in late 73 his service had been satisfactory. In related news, the former Texas Speaker of the House, Ben Barnes, is scheduled to appear on 60 Minutes tonight to discuss how he helped Bush get a coveted slot in the National Guard in 1968. In other campaign news, Vice President Dick Cheney warned voters the election of John Kerry would result in a major attack against the U.S. He said, quote, "It's absolutely essential that 8 weeks from today, on November 2nd, we make the right choice, because if we make the wrong choice, then the danger is that we'll get hit again, and we'll be hit in a way that will be devastating." In response, vice presidential candidate John Edwards said, quote, "Dick Cheney's scare tactics crossed the line today, showing once again he and George Bush will do anything and say anything to save their jobs." The Washington Post is reporting that President Bush may skip one of the three presidential debates proposed by the Commission on Presidential Debates. The Bush team is resisting an October 8th town meeting debate in Missouri, where the candidates would take questions from undecided voters in the St. Louis area. According to the Post, Bush officials are concerned people might pose as undecided voters when they are actually partisans. In other election news, the New York Daily News is reporting Fox News host Bill O'Reilly is considering challenging Hillary Clinton for her New York Senate seat. Federal investigators from the Government Accountability Office have determined the Bush administration illegally withheld data from Congress on the cost of the actual new Medicare law. The investigators recommended the former head of the Medicare agency, Thomas Scully, pay as a penalty 7 months of his salary. Scully, who now works as lobbyist for several major health care companies, said he would not pay the suggested penalty. In other Medicare news, on Friday, the Bush administration quietly announced a record increase in next year's Medicare premiums for doctor visits, this according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. The increase of $11.60 a month was the largest ever in the program's 40-year history. In Gaza City, tens of thousands of Palestinians took to the streets for the funerals of 14 members of Hamas killed in an attack by Israel. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kurey warned that there would be a Palestinian response. He said, quote, "No crime goes unpunished. For sure there will be retaliation." The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Pentagon plans to break up Halliburton's $13 billion contract in Iraq and put the contract out to bid.
أسقيك من أسقيك من مدمعي ما كنت.
Farida, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The number of Americans killed in Iraq has topped 1,000, as at least 15 U.S. troops died in fierce fighting over the past 2 days. The grim milestone was reached 18 months after the U.S. launched its invasion of Iraq early. Around half of those killed are between 18 and 24 years old. This according to Pentagon statistics cited by Agence France-Presse. All but 140 of the 1,000 deaths have come since May 1st, 2003, when U.S. President George Bush declared an end to major combat operations under a banner reading Mission Accomplished. Donald Rumsfeld sought to play down the impact of the 1,000 milestone, telling reporters at the Pentagon that the, quote, civilized world had long passed the 1,000th death at the hands of terrorists. He cited 3,000 deaths during the attacks on September 11th and the hundreds who died in the school siege in southern Russia last weekend. The number of Iraqis killed since March 2003 is unknown. We turn now to Patrick Coburn, journalist with the London Independent. He's in Baghdad right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. You've just written a piece, U.S. military death toll on Iraqi soil tops 1,000. Can you talk about the significance of this milestone?
Well, it shows above all that the war is intensifying month by month. Maybe there's an over, we look too much at the number of dead. We should also look at the number of wounded, 7,000. And many of these people have suffered terrible wounds that they would have died in previous wars, people who've lost to all their limbs, people who will never move out of a wheelchair in future. But in Iraq, what's very noticeable now, and maybe it hasn't impressed the outside world, that it's a war on two fronts, that American soldiers are dying at the hands of Shiite Muslims, which wasn't true 6 months ago, as well as these continuing guerrilla attacks by the Sunni Muslims west and north of Baghdad.
We're talking to Patrick Coburn. He's in Baghdad. Can you describe right now the scene in Baghdad? Can you describe what's happening, the level of the fighting? Can you talk about what people in this country should understand about Iraq?
Well, there's fighting all over the city. I mean, if you look at Baghdad from a distance, that isn't at first obvious, although you could see the flashes of shells going off in Sadr City last night. But if you look at it more closely, you find there's violence everywhere. You have street fighting in East Baghdad with very heavy casualties, over 200 people killed and wounded yesterday. Then in other parts of the city, I was looking at one place where a very typical ambush of an American Humvee, one soldier killed, one wounded, a very large mine dug in beside the road. And I was looking actually on top of a roof of one of the houses. The buckled remains of a machine gun was lying on the roof, and one of the doors had been torn off the Humvee and hurled a good 40, 50 yards over the house. And about 5 minutes away, there had been a very expert assassination attempt against the governor of Baghdad, gunman opening fire behind and in front of his convoy, intending them to go down a side street where another large bomb had been prepared, and two people, completely innocent, were killed in this. So all over the city, you have violence occurring. And there's no sign of this ending, and in fact, it seems to be escalating.
What about the two 29-year-old Italian women, along with two Iraqis, who were kidnapped, part of a bridge to Baghdad? The group, perhaps the longest-standing foreign peace group in Iraq since the Persian Gulf War, more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, yes, well, this was particularly shocking. partly because the people targeted had done nothing except good to Iraq. And secondly, this was in broad daylight in the center of the capital, near the National Theater. It doesn't work, but it's that's the nearest big building. And they turned up in heavily armed. At first, people thought they were government security forces, slapped around the guards and kidnapped these two women. While it was, they were quite well known here, they aren't people whom anybody thought would be targeted by kidnappers.
What do you expect to happen now? And are you getting any sense of the debate in the United States? Is there coverage here, is there coverage in Iraq of the presidential contest here in the United States?
I'm not sure I quite understood that, but the Iraqis are very conscious that the presidential election is going on, that this is the background to everything that is happening here. And that may explain events, certainly does explain events earlier in the year of the tremendous attack on Fallujah in April, which was suddenly called off. Now, Iraqis sort of assumed that both the attack and the sudden ceasefire, leaving Fallujah in the hands of the rebels, that the real initiative came from the White House and not from the military commanders here.
And finally, Patrick Coburn, your response to the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld incorporating Iraq into the war on terror when responding to questions about 1,000 soldiers dead, saying, quotes, the civilized world had long passed the 1,000th death at the hands of terrorists, citing 9/11 and the hundreds who died in Russia in the school.
Well, obviously, there is a horrible irony about that, that, I mean, there's never been any evidence produced that the terrorism of which previously, that the one place that al-Qaeda didn't operate was Iraq, because they were at daggers drawn with Saddam. Of course, now, because of the war, it could be much easier for any Islamic militant to come to Iraq to find sympathizers here. But that's a situation created by Rumsfeld and by the war and the occupation. So it seems to me a horrible irony in the claim that somehow the 1,000 Soviet invasion of Iraq occurred because of terrorism, and the complete failure to admit that they've done nothing except do terrorists a favor by invading this country.
How?
Because they've created a great base here for anybody. I mean, anybody in the Middle East or elsewhere who wants to act against the U.S., against Britain, can now find succor in Iraq. Large parts of this country are outside the control of the interim Iraqi government or the U.S. forces. There's no evidence that the Iraqis were behind any of the al-Qaeda attacks previously. It's now a much more potent base for Islamic militant groups than Afghanistan ever was. But this is the result of the actions, it seems to me, of Rumsfeld and President Bush.
Patrick Coburn, I want to thank you for being with us, journalist with the London Independent, speaking to us from Baghdad. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll examine the tactics of the police department last week during the Republican National Convention. Stay with us.
حياتي رضيت به مولاي رضيت به
Farida here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Republican National Convention has wrapped up here in New York, but discussion rages about some of the tactics of the New York Police Department used in its security operations. During the convention, the NYPD operated with a budget of $60 million, larger than all but 19 of the world's standing armies. And they were certainly not alone. In Lower Manhattan, the Multi-Agency Command Center, or MAC, was the security nerve center, with some 66 separate city, state, and federal agencies coordinating their work. While the police have declared last week a success, there were a number of incidents and tactics that have come under fire from civil liberties advocates and legal groups. In a moment, we'll be joined by two lawyers working on the cases stemming from last week's protests. But first, we'll get the perspective of the police. On the last night of the RNC, I had a chance to talk with Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins across the barricades at 30th and 8th Avenue, where more protesters continued to gather as President Bush spoke inside. Here is some of what Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins had to say.
Our strategy this week was to ensure that the rights of all New Yorkers and all visitors to New York were protected, and that people who needed to go to work, go about their daily lives, could do so with as little interference as possible with preparations for the convention, with preparations for any demonstrations that were planned. And I think overall we accomplished that mission. Most people could get around New York as needed. Most of the demonstrations went off without incident. And when there was law breaking, police used minimal force in effecting those arrests. There were very few people injured on the police side and on the demonstrator side. With just about everyone in the crowd or every other person in the crowd with a camera, I've not seen any video or pictures that trouble me. It looked like the police were very professional and patient.
That was Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins on the barricade on the last night of the Republican National Convention, just after President Bush addressed the convention at the Madison Square Garden, a couple blocks above where Collins was. We're joined right now by Donna Lieberman, Executive Director of the New York Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Mark Steyer with the Mass Defense Committee of the New York City National Lawyers Guild. Why don't you start, Donna Lieberman, with your response to what the deputy police chief had to say?
Well, I think the deputy police chief must not have seen the videos, which were aired on TV, of hundreds of people being swept up for following the instructions of the police department as to how they could have a lawful march. That happened across from Ground Zero on Fulton Street with the War Resisters League demonstration. It happened in Union Square or off Union Square on 17th Street, where a group of protesters negotiated, where do we march lawfully? Go on the sidewalk. They went on the sidewalk and boom, they were swept up. That's not to mention the scores of bystanders, maybe hundreds, who were swept up in the indiscriminate sweeps. And those sweeps included, you know, bystanders, press people, medics, legal observers, and we believe that indeed the police department may have been targeting the green-hatted guild legal observers. Our observers from the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Blue Cap were not targeted. Only one received a summons, and that was like an utter case of harassment for which we'll be filing a complaint. But I think we have a lot to investigate here. indiscriminate arrests is just the tip of the iceberg. We saw a couple of incidents of violence. He must have missed the mopeds, police in plain clothes driving their mopeds into the crowd on Monday night. And then I think the huge story is about the indefinite or the prolonged detention of people who were arrested. The police bragged that they were giving out DATs in virtually all the cases, but
desk
they held
appearance tickets.
Thank you, which is supposed to be the fast track to getting out on a minor offense, and it took tons longer, days longer to get out on a DAT, desk appearance ticket for a disorderly conduct than it would take on a misdemeanor charge or even a felony charge. And then, of course, there are the conditions at the pier, at Pier 57. The New York Civil Liberties Union has taken a sample of Pier 57 that was brought to us, and we're having it analyzed for toxic chemicals.
So let's talk about the scope of what happened last week. Watching the talk shows this weekend, no one might have realized the level of the protest as they wrapped up the significance of the week. We're talking about the largest mass protest in the history of political conventions. We're talking about the largest number of people arrested in a single day, over 1,000 on Tuesday, in the city's history. The single largest number of arrests, and one of the largest in the history of this country. And overall, the number of arrests, close to 2,000, more than 1,800. Let's go to the videotape again, to Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins, talking about several issues, including the conditions at Pier 57.
And what new technology did you bring in the $60, $70 million that was spent on security?
New technology that was used in the this week. I think it was some security things that were instituted over at the Garden, Madison Square Garden, in the surrounding area. Relative to the demonstrations, I don't know of any new technology that was unveiled, so to speak.
What's going on?
It looks like they're sending some officers home due to the peaceful nature of the demonstration.
The criticism that there were many Democracy Now! Radio and TV show, that there were many people who were caught up in a kind of dragnet. I mean, for this number of arrests, 1,700, not given warning, the police would move in very quickly from one side, the uniformed police coming down a sidewalk. Undercover cops would come up on their mopeds or motorcycles. Undercovers would be in front, stopping the, a group of people from moving forward, and then the one fell swoop moving in and arresting people without the bullhorn, without warning people.
I'm not familiar with the tactics you're describing, but I know that we are trained. We train our officers to, if possible, give a warning, give people an opportunity to disperse, and then arrest them. However, in some situations, that's impossible to do. Each situation is different and unique, and each situation, each arrest will be evaluated by the district attorney's office and by the court.
Do you feel pleased with what happened this week?
I think overall, the rights of the protesters, the rights of the people participating in the Republican convention, and the rights of all New Yorkers and all visitors to New York were pretty well defended and upheld.
Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins. We'll talk about Pier 57 in a minute, but what about this point, Donna Lieberman, of the technology?
Boy, do we see technology. We saw, like, old-type tactics like orange netting, which is not very techno-sophisticated, but we also saw...
Explain what you mean when you say orange netting.
Well, the preferred arrest mechanism was to use this plastic orange mesh that's used at construction sites often to wrap people up, and the police would pull it out without warning and just grab in anybody in the path. That included press people, medics, legal observers, and you couldn't get out except occasionally if you were able to establish press credentials. But there was also more sophisticated methodology in place, and that's video surveillance, helmets with video cameras on their heads, on them, and a mass of surveillance cameras ostensibly to protect Madison Square Garden, but aimed right at the protest site, the designated area south of the garden on 8th Avenue. We counted, we did a survey at the NYCLU of the number of video cameras on 8th Avenue south of 31st Street in the protest area and came up with like over 26 cameras. The same area on 9th Avenue only had a handful of cameras, and on 7th Avenue only a handful. So there is clearly an effort underway to videotape demonstrations. The undercover cameras were just a piece of it. At every demonstration, lawful or not, police officers were there videotaping. And this is intimidating. It's also raising concerns about the maintenance of political dossiers on people, which is just harks back to the bad old days of the Red Squad and all of our FBI files or NYPD files, and is a time not so honored technique of intimidation and dirty tricks.
Mark Steyer, would you like to expand on that?
Even I have to agree, the chilling effect, the video cameras all up and down the protest areas. Members of the of TARU, which is the videotaping unit for the police department, were not the only ones videotaping. Undercover police were videotaping, and undercover police teams were actually shadowing a number of protesters using their first names as they passed by. How you doing, so-and-so? So very chilling behavior by the police. I don't know about what Deputy Chief Collins saw, but I can speak to 12, 16 hours a day on the street of having seen arbitrary arrests, arbitrary filming, and lawful permitted protests were being filmed extensively.
Now, what about this issue? I think many people would say it's not as if the police were beating the protesters. They were just taking pictures of them. What's wrong with that?
Okay, well, actually, one thing is wrong with that. On Monday night, at the end of a permitted march, they allowed the Kensington Poor People's Economic Campaign to march into the protest zone and then started penning people in, offensively using these metal barricades against people. I was pinned up against a light post, and there are a number of people who filmed motor scooter undercover cops ramming into the crowd with their vehicles. A very unsafe condition was created by the police department at that time. And, of course, all of this has been captured on videotape, not just legal observers, but the PD itself hasn't issued any of their videotape showing, the unruliness that required a whole squad of motor cops to ram into a crowd.
I think the Kensington demonstration is an example of the Jekyll and Hyde policing that we saw, actually. There was no permit for that march, yet the police department agreed to and negotiated a march route, and it went on for the most part without incident. There were some problems along the course of the route, but that was an example of good policing, and we saw other examples of that during the course of the week that facilitated hundreds of thousands of people, as you said, in the most sustained, prolonged, voluminous demonstrations that our country has seen in the context of a convention. But at the end of the march, we saw whether it was rogue cops or by design, and a number of police officials at the higher levels have indicated that they understand that this was wrong, but it happened. Coming out with the metal barricades, charging the crowd and flipping people out, creating a melee and compounding the problem by driving the mopeds driven by plainclothes officers into the crowd.
So let's explain. When you say driving mopeds by plainclothes officers, we saw this several times. The people who are protesting have no idea who these people are. They come into the crowd driving in their mopeds, often wearing Yankees jerseys.
Babe Ruth 3.
And They don't know if they're a gang. They don't know what's going on, right. But they know that they're being plowed right. into.
Mm-hmm. They're totally intimidating. I was on my bicycle going uptown on 8th Avenue Sunday night and saw this wedge of motorcycles and was, you know, I got off my bike and went onto the sidewalk. I knew who they were, but I knew who they were. When you're in a demonstration and aren't busy monitoring the police activities and haven't heard about these, you don't know. So people think they're being attacked by vigilantes. It's unfortunate that one of the police officers was hurt. I understand that he's okay, and that's good news. But this is the kind of tactic that needs to be investigated and exposed and addressed for future reference. You know, the RNC may be gone, but protest certainly isn't.
But this issue of photographing, which goes back to something called the Handshoe Agreement, can you describe what the Handshoe Agreement is and why there's a problem with videotaping? When can police videotape and when can't they?
Well, there's no clear answer to that. It's a matter of intense dispute right now. The police maintain that they can videotape anything and everything, and they do it. The lawyers in the Handshoe case, you know, who've been the lawyers on this case for like 20 years, have written to the court asking for limits and complaining about the pervasive videotaping that was going on prior to the RNC. The concern about videotaping, you know, everybody's doing it. Indy Media is doing, credentialed media is doing it. The concern about government doing it is not that the government shouldn't have access to public information. It's that the government shouldn't be maintaining political dossiers on people. That's what they did during the McCarthy period. That's what they did during the civil rights and anti-war movements. And they can't do it now because what they do when they have these political dossiers is selectively release the information, selectively use half-truth to target political opponents of the administration. And it's important that we put a lid on this pervasive police intimidation tactic, which, by the way, now is also coupled with another tactic from the McCarthy period. It's the law enforcement stakeouts. A number of political activists have reported that they were staked out. Jennifer Flynn was home in New Jersey at her parents' house over the weekend, and there were clearly identifiable police vehicles staking her out in the suburbs.
And who was Jennifer Flynn?
Jennifer Flynn was one of the leaders of the Still We Rise coalition that organized the Monday afternoon demonstration. She participated with me, with Chris Dunn, in negotiations with police on how to do it lawfully. And other people have reported that they've been trailed by the police in obvious 1950s kind of ways. So this regression to the bad old days is a serious problem, and we'll be addressing it in litigation, in city council hearings, and in the public, because we have to put an end to it.
I want to go back to Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins talking about the conditions in which people were kept.
To Pier 57 and the complaints that it hasn't been used to put human beings in for quite a while. I was speaking with a transit worker union worker who said there was this big fire in 94, very serious issues of asbestos abatement not fully done, and a lot of the people who've been put there not for 15 minutes or an hour, but for hours and days, that this was not a safe facility to be in.
The New York City Police Department would not put prisoners, because when you put prisoners in a location, in an unsafe location, if you put prisoners there, you have to put our employees there. So we wouldn't expose our employees nor the prisoners to anything unsafe. The air on that pier was tested as recently as, I believe, Tuesday or Wednesday night. Today's Tuesday night. It was found to be safe. The place was clean and sufficient for what its purpose was designed for, and inspected and cleaned after every use. It was not designed to keep people there for days, and in fact, nobody stayed there for days. People were processed there. The longest, I believe, somebody stayed on the pier was 8 to 10 hours, tops, and then they wound up in the courts. They were not kept there. That was not designed to keep them there for days.
Deputy Police Chief Michael Collins, Mark Steyer of the Mass Defense Committee of New York City National Lawyers Guild, your response.
We have dozens of complaints from people who were kept at Pier 57 that the conditions there were intolerable. They have rashes, persistent coughs. Asthmatics have attributed their stay there to attacks. We actually have a sample that's being tested right now of the both the wall and the floor of this bus depot. It hasn't been used for, you know, years, except by buses. This is a, this is a mistake by Deputy Chief Collins. I don't think that he saw the conditions there at Pier 57. And I hope on behalf of the unionized workers who had to be there as long as they did, along with protesters, that they do actually come forward and admit that this was a grave mistake.
Donna Lieberman.
You know, the city made clear in the months leading up to the convention that they were well prepared for up to 1,000 arrests a day. They didn't have as much as they said that they were prepared for. Nonetheless, people were thrown into this possibly toxic, certainly filthy facility, and people were not processed for days. So we have to ask the question, if they were so well prepared, was there a malfunction or was it by design?
Chief Collins said that, well, that wasn't the city's fault. That was something to do with the state, Albany, not being able to process the fingerprints.
Does the word baloney fly? We were told that in fact there wasn't a problem with the NYSIS. That's the state, database prints. I think that it's important for us that we bring litigation challenging these detentions, partly to vindicate the rights of the individuals, but also partly to find out sworn testimony what happened, what went wrong, who is responsible, and why.
And in fact, today a judge will be having a hearing on what amount the city owes in contempt charges for having held people up to 60 hours, 70 hours.
What about that issue? Right before President Bush addressed the RNC, the judge ruling that if these hundreds of demonstrators at that moment that had been designated were not released, that there would be a fine of $1,000 per protester held. The implication of all this is that the protesters were just being held through the week to hold them past President Bush's speech.
Well, I think it was the Tuesday crowd of arrestees that was at issue. That's 1,000 people or so, several hundred of whom were illegally arrested. It may well be. I think that we're going to find out in the course of litigation whether, in fact, that was the plan. But you know, virtually everybody was released by, you know, the end of the speech. Yeah. So the pieces of the puzzle just, you know, seem like they're coming together.
In terms of policing method, this is the same sort of thing that was seen at the FTA protest down in Florida. They arrested people and tried to hold them as long as possible with the connivance in Florida of the courts. And I think that I remember hearing a quote from someone in the police department that was, in fact, a tactic that would be used here.
Yeah, I think one thing that we just have to remember as we criticize, you know,
and we're wrapping on this.
As we criticize what the police did, and they made a number of errors and violated people's rights in a number of ways, that hundreds of thousands of people did get to protest the administration's policies in a peaceful way. The protesters were overwhelmingly peaceful, contrary to what Chief Kelly would have had us believe in the days and weeks and months leading up to the convention.
On that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Donna Lieberman, Executive Director, New York Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Mark Steyer, Attorney with the Mass Defense Committee of the New York City National Lawyers Guild. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll go to California to look at police behavior in another case, a trial that's happening today. Stay with us.
To stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you...
Gil Scott-Heron, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On three separate occasions in a three-week span in the fall of 97, Humboldt police officers arrived at peaceful sit-in protests calling for the protection of Headwaters Forest in Northern California. On all three occasions, the activists, who ranged in age from 16 to 40, locked their arms in metal pipes to participate in a nonviolent protest of logging practices. And on all three occasions, the police responded using a method that Amnesty International would later deem, quote, tantamount to torture. One by one, police officers forcibly seized the heads of each demonstrator and inserted cotton swabs saturated with chemical agent pepper spray into their eyes. In two of the cases, officers also sprayed the substance directly into their eyes at close range. On the video, it looked as if the police were performing operations on the eyes of each of the protesters. The eight activists filed a civil rights lawsuit against Humboldt County. In connection with the suit, police videotapes of the pepper spray were released to the public. When excerpt of the tapes aired on network TV news, the graphic images drew international outrage and condemnation. The case went to court in 98, but the trial ended in a hung jury. Over the following years, challenges were made at the state appeals court and U.S. Supreme Court levels. Today, the civil rights case of the pepper spray 8 returns to trial in San Francisco. To talk about the case, we're joined by two people, the San Francisco lead counsel in the lawsuit, Dennis Cunningham, and one of the plaintiffs in the case, Spring Lundberg. Before we speak to them, though, we're going to go back 7 years to that morning, September 25th, 1997, where Spring and other activists were engaging in a sit-in protest at Pacific Lumber's offices in Scotia, California. The police arrived on the scene. This is what happened.
I'm requesting that you leave immediately within 5 minutes or you'll be subject to arrest. It is my intention, if you do not leave, to use pepper spray or chemical mace to extricate you from the steel cases. About 5 minutes.
5 minutes started ticking down, and I remember looking at the clock, and it was all about intimidation, really.
Okay, folks, your time is up. I've given you 5 minutes. Are you going to leave your bikes and leave this building? Okay, we'll be starting using pepper spray then. Marvin?
Are you going to release?
I'm not good.
Videotape from police included in a documentary called Fire in the Eyes, courtesy of Earth Films. We're joined now by Dennis Cunningham and Spring Lundberg. Dennis Cunningham, the lawyer, Spring Lundberg, one of the protesters. Spring, you yourself, what exactly happened then?
Well, as you said, we went to Pacific Lumber's headquarters office that day, and I was 17 at the time. I had grown up in Humboldt County and saw the huge redwood trees going out on the log trucks. So I had an early education in resource extraction and how our economy works, and I decided this is something I want to put myself on the line for. I want to take action for this issue. So I went to the offices expecting to be arrested and expecting to be responsible for the consequences of my action. But instead, the police that day, you know, created this get tough policy, this experimental pepper spray tactic, and they crossed the line that day. So we're excited to start trial today because our case is about holding the police accountable to the consequences of their actions, which shocked people when they saw the footage.
So the police use pepper spray using Q-tips and applying it to the eyelids of the individual protesters. Dennis Cunningham, this case today, this trial, where is it being held? Where does it stand in the whole legal process? I mean, it's now, what, 7 years later?
Well, this is a retrial. It's in the district court, a trial court, the federal court. And there was a long process of appeal after the earlier trial, and then another postponement when we made a petition after the judge we used to have wanted to take the case up to Humboldt County for trial, which we thought was exactly the wrong thing to do. And then so there was an appeal from that, and he was removed from the case, and now we have a different judge. That's what's taken so long to get back to trial.
Spring, what exactly did it feel like, the pepper spray, cotton swabs, the Q-tips applied with your eyes, eyelids rolled back?
Well, the first thing was just feeling terrified, really. And then the pain kicked in, and this is caustic stuff. There's DuPont emulsifiers and pepper spray. This stuff has dissolved latex gloves when officers have squeezed out cotton balls that were soaked in pepper spray onto people's faces. It felt like acid eating my face, frankly, and who knows the long-term effects, damage to the skin tissue of something like this. But really, the overwhelming feeling was they're terrorizing us, and it's for our beliefs. And so that's why a case like this is important. We try to put it in a larger context. It's important, you know, we're thinking about the Republican National Convention. We're living under the Patriot Act and post-September 11th. As a society, we're trying to ask ourselves, okay, where is the line that we're trying to hold police accountability to? And so it's not just about what happened to me, although I want to talk about that as well. It was a painful experience, and for a 17-year-old, a life-changing one. But it's about the larger picture, and so many images never make the evening news, never make it even onto radio, or, you know, never come to light. And so we wanted our case to be a window to shed light on a lot of abuses that happen.
I'm looking at a report from the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights called When Police Play Russian Roulette, which makes the case for an immediate moratorium on police use of pepper spray, introduced into the late 1980s. It says, in the short time pepper spray has been on the market, at least 100 people nationwide have died in police custody after being pepper sprayed. Since it was first introduced by law enforcement agencies in the late 80s, no reliable studies have been completed showing that it's safe for use on humans. To the contrary, a growing body of evidence cataloged in this report that makes the case that pepper spray is both dangerous and unreliable.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And a former FBI agent, Thomas Ward, was the man responsible for the original study that said, hey, pepper spray is good stuff. Let's put it all on police tool belts. And he was convicted of taking kickbacks, money, donations to him from the pepper spray industry. So that's the study that, you know, everything was based on. But that never went back and got looked at. And so here we're dealing with this, you know, unknown substance. And not only that, but as an instrument of discrimination or torture.
Dennis Cunningham, what will happen in court today?
We expect to pick a jury, or at least start picking a jury. And, you know, it's possible we get started with opening statements. Probably that'll happen tomorrow.
We'd like to ask people to come out to the trial. We saw in the Judy Berry trial, which Dennis and our legal team was part of, Judy Berry versus FBI, we saw the jury really, you know, see supporters in the courtroom and be affected by that because they saw that we had support. And so we'd like people to come on down. It's at the Federal Building in San Francisco. And we have a website that's nopepperspray.org.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Spring Lundberg, one of the eight plaintiffs in the case against Humboldt County. She was 17 years at the time of the protests, 17 years old. And Dennis Cunningham, San Francisco, civil rights and criminal defense attorney. As we turn now to our last subject, the United States has denied entry to one of Europe's most influential Islamic thinkers. Tariq Ramadan, a Swiss scholar known for his work on Islamic theology and the place of Muslims in the modern world, was appointed to teach Islamic philosophy and ethics at the University of Notre Dame. He received a visa from the State Department, was scheduled to start classes in late August. But just days before he was set to travel, his visa was revoked without explanation at the behest of the Department of Homeland Security. It turns out that Ramadan was barred under a section of the Patriot Act, which bars entry to foreigners who've used, quote, a position of prominence to endorse or espouse terrorist activity. The move has been widely criticized by academics in the U.S. who suspect that Tariq Ramadan had been barred because of his criticism of U.S. foreign policy. Islamic scholars regard Ramadan as a Muslim moderate, but critics regard him as an anti-Semitic apologist for extremism. Among them is Daniel Pipes, the director of the Middle East Forum and of Campus Watch, a website that seeks to expose professors who allegedly hold anti-Israel views. Pipes wrote in the Chicago Tribune to accuse Ramadan of connections with al-Qaeda, denying Osama bin Laden's role in the September 11th attacks and defending the March terrorist bombing in Madrid. Tariq Ramadan joins us on the phone right now from Switzerland, where he's a professor of Islamic studies and philosophy at Freiburg University, author of To Be a European Muslim and Western Muslims and the Future of Islam. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Ramadan.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to the attacks on you and to the U.S. government withdrawing the visa for you to teach at the University of Notre Dame?
Yes, you know, when I went first to the American Embassy in Switzerland, I gave my file and everything was okay, and I went through a 2-month clearance procedure, and nothing was on my file. So to come now with very old allegations I heard before, you know, 10 years ago, and saying that this is why now the visa has been revoked is inconsistent, because, you know, and to say, for example, he is the grandson of Hassan al-Banna. I was the grandson of Hassan al-Banna last May when I received the first visa. So I think that it's not there is nothing new in all this. And what I'm saying to all the detractors, I'm telling them, look, if you have something to say or allegations, come with the evidence. Because if you don't have evidence, I'm not going to follow you in a very, very bad way. You know, you are acting against the dignity of your mind, and you are acting against the dignity of my person. So if you don't have evidences, I'm not going to waste my time with this. I know that I have nothing to do with terrorism. I criticize, and I condemn every kind of terrorist from the very beginning, and this was 15 years ago. I started to be very critical towards all the radical movements. So there is nothing new in my file. So up to now, so far, we have no explanation why I was denied entering the United States.
Professor Tariq Ramadan has been described by Time magazine as one of the 100 most likely innovators of the 21st century. What has been the response of the University of Notre Dame since they were the ones that invited you to teach?
No, the university has a very, very strong stance saying that we are supporting Tariq Ramadan. They went also through a very meticulous, you know, inquiry about me, knowing what I'm doing, the writings in Arabic, in English, in French, and they know that there is nothing in my file, so they are very supportive. And this is also what I have to say to all the American Muslims. Look, you are in a society where, of course, sometimes the feeling is that the Muslims are targeted because they are Muslims. But at the same time, you have people, you know, like this university and so many other academics, professors, organizations, or radios, or media, now having the feeling that this is their, you know, civil rights are at risk if it's possible for someone to be banned from a country only because he is a Muslim or he has a critical, you know, approach towards the
Professor
American
Ramadan,
policy.
we have to leave it.
We
have to leave it there because the show is ending, but we are going to ask you to rejoin us for part two of this discussion. That does it for Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shreef Abdul-Qudus, Jeremy Scahan, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.